Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Your life, your country. You're listening to the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Welcome to the best of the Laura Ingraham Podcast. Thanks for listening. There's so many memorable guests and unforgettable moments from both radio over the years and this podcast. And I thought it'd be a great time during this vacation period to put some of this together so you have it at your fingertips. Conversations with my most incredibly scintillating guests, hilarious moments, all unforgettable. Enjoy it here on the Laura Ingraham Podcast.
Would you be willing to vote for some border security money, wall money, barrier money, to give permanent protection to DACA children, DACA young people?
Let me be very clear. I'm not going to vote for a wall under any circumstances, and I do support border security. And if we want to talk about that, let's do that. And let's talk about what really accomplishes border security, which is let's upgrade the technology. Let's look at the fact that the folks who are working on border security on the ground know that they need upgraded infrastructure around things like drones, and they need cameras. So, yes, I'm all for increased border security where we need it. Yeah, I am not for a wall.
Yeah. Well, of course, if she bothered to actually care about what the Border Patrol say about a wall, well, maybe Kamala Harris, the it girl of the moment for the progressives, maybe she would think differently.
The fencing that we currently have can be defeated. Anybody can come up to that fence with a welding torch and cut a hole in it. In fact, they have. I personally was assigned to find holes in the fence. My brother was assigned for 3 years to patch holes as a Border Patrol agent, to patch holes in the fence. And that was a daily activity that he was doing. So yes, we absolutely have to have a barrier that can't be defeated. And if we do a wall and we do it properly on the border, we can in fact effectuate a better arrest rate. We can in fact secure the border. I'm 100% positive that can happen.
Joining us now is Tricia Elbrock. She's a rancher and a business owner who lives in Animas, New Mexico, near our southern border. She has quite a story to tell. Tricia, well, Kamala Harris says we don't need a wall. I know your view on that, the view of many ranchers is, well, we need a wall. We need a lot of stuff, but we definitely need to slow the traffic that's crossing the border. But specifically with your experience, what could you tell us about life at the border to illustrate just how bad and how dangerous it's become with the cartels and their easy access to America?
Okay, yes, we do need a wall in certain areas. And then where we can't put a wall, then you need, drones, extra men on the ground. They also need to man that wall. But we definitely do need a wall in certain areas. But we've got masses, right now we got masses of illegals coming across at the port of entry in Antelope Wells, which is only manned from 10 o'clock in the morning to 4 in the afternoon from Monday through Fridays, and it's not manned on the weekends. So that is our weakest point along the border, and they're coming through in groves, anywhere from 100 people to 400 people at a time. And then they have to be, when they surrender and want medical help, then they have to be bused 90 miles to Lordsburg, New Mexico, which is about 100 miles from the Antelope Wells, which is 40 miles from Animas. And when you have, 400 people in a facility that can only handle 100, you got mass deplorable conditions. We also provided porta potties, and of course the conditions of those porta potties were not good, because you know 4 porta potties is not going to handle. But we got masses coming across, and with that, there are a lot of sick people, which put a strain on our county. Our county's only like 4,000 square feet or square miles, and we've got a total of maybe 4,000 people in our county, and we only have 4 deputies to service our county. And so then when they bring those people across the border into our, and we don't have a hospital here, all we have is clinics and EMT, so our clinics are being overwhelmed to treat the people that are coming across.
Yeah, it's a disaster. Field. Tricia, we get it. The hospitals are overrun, the people are fed up, you got bad medical situation. Tell me about your employee who was kidnapped before we let
yes.
you go.
Okay. In December, like, we also sell service water. We're all private wells, private septics. We take care of all this ranch down there at the near the border. Well, he went to service a water problem in December 7th, 2015. And he was overpowered with, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. There was three truckloads of drugs that cut through the barbed wire fence, and they got one truck stuck, and they, apprehended my man with our truck trying to pull theirs out, and it couldn't, so they threw all of our equipment and tools out. They kidnapped my guy, stole our truck, and piled all the drugs onto our truck and waited till dark to come out of there. They tore all the electronics out of that truck so they couldn't have lights or in case we had a tracer on it. So then when he didn't show up at dark, his wife called. He always called because there's no cell service down there. So when he got in cell service, he would call his wife, and he didn't call. And at 8 o'clock, we went out searching.
Okay, so what happened? What's the bottom line? What's the bottom line here?
That we got him back alive. We got drug cartels, and the cartels are everywhere. Drugs are coming through here. This is a corridor for drugs.
Why do you stay? I have a human interest question. Why do you stay? I got to say, I wouldn't stay. If my country and my county was not protecting my property and my people, I would hightail it out of there. I wouldn't even stay.
Well,
why do you stay?
We had a big meeting because this is our livelihood. I've got a ranch. I have employ 18 people here. You know, there's farmers and ranches here. This is our livelihood. Where in the hell are we going to go?
Yeah, that's your home.
And we service all southeast Arizona, southwest New Mexico. We have an obligation to our communities here. But, yes, you know, people, FBI, after the kidnapping, ask us why we stay. Well, this is, you're going to turn this over to the cartels? Is this going to turn it over to Mexico and say, okay, you anything below Highway 9 you can have? No, we're not going to do that.
But so I want everyone who's listening to the Laura Ingraham podcast to just take a breath with us and focus on what Tricia Elbrock, who owns this ranch in New Mexico at the border, what she just said. She's a woman, a business owner, employs people. She's a native of this area. This is her home. This is her homeland. And what she's saying is she owes an obligation to her customers and her employees. My question is, doesn't the county and the country, the federal government, the state government, owe an obligation to her as a citizen of New Mexico? Why don't we have the state government and the federal government owing more of an obligation to the American people and to protect your livelihood, protect your people? You're not asking for handouts. You're asking for the basics, which is we have a border, enforce the darn border. This is a travesty. And didn't you have some cave near your property that you guys found some weapons in?
Yes, on top of my ranch, we have a cave up there that you can see both valleys. And they found semi-automatic rifles, high-powered telescopes, and they stay in there. And, of course, just over the weekend, we found that we've got a scout, and a scout is a guy that goes ahead of the drug runs to make sure, you know, what lays ahead. And there is one on our ranch now. We have to be careful. And just last night, my grandson at dark was taking feed out to a water trough for the cows, and he ran into a bunch of illegals with flashlights. And, of course, he hightailed out of there. But we live this every day. We pack guns ourselves. We have to protect ourselves because our government is not doing it. I think they think more of these illegals than they do of us down here, and that is wrong. And we're getting stirred up around here because our government needs to take care of us. Our state needs to take care of us, and our federal government needs to. We are United States citizens.
Unless
we go across the border and they come in here illegally, and then maybe they'll take care of us. But we have a right for our government to take care of us down here, and they're not doing that.
Well, what about your fellow New Mexicans? I mean, you have a very significant Latino Hispanic population in New Mexico. It's almost a majority Latino state at this point, correct? I mean, it's
yes.
pretty high up there. So what are they saying about this? I mean, they can't be happy.
A lot of our employees are Hispanic. Probably half of my employees are Hispanic. And they came across legally. They did it right. You know, they came through the proper channels, and they are against all these illegals coming. You know, they can't go to our clinics and get help, medical help, because they postpone or cancel an appointment for all these illegals they have to take care of, which strains our resources because we're a poor county and we can't handle that. We need help down here. We only have four deputies for our county. We need help. We need more boots on the ground. Our border patrols are being overrun with all these masses of people coming across. They need more border patrol. They need help.
And Susana Martinez was the outgoing Republican governor, former Republican governor of New Mexico, and she was pretty squishy on this border stuff, as I recall. I mean, she was not all that great on the border. But now, you know, you have a Democrat in place, and now what do you expect? What do you think is going
to
happen now?
I don't expect much, because she's making a push to make New Mexico a sanctuary state, and if she does that, we're all lost down here. She'll go to the border at Santa Teresa, where it's all, you know, got walls and the most secure border in New Mexico, and say there's no crisis here. Well, yeah, she's at a secure place with walls and stuff. Sure, there's no crisis there. Come out where the barbed wire fence is, where we live, and experience what we're experiencing, but she won't do that. You know, and we had on KOB news media, and her spokesman came on after she saw that news feed and said that we were anti-Americans and anti-immigration and whatnot. No, that's not true. I'm all for legal immigration. I am an American citizen, and I believe in our United States Constitution. I think a lot of our politicians are not following that constitution.
Well, and again, for people who don't remember, the incoming governor, the new governor, not incoming, she's already obviously sworn in, was a Democrat Congresswoman, Michelle Lujan Grisham. And
right.
She was heralded as, you know, the first Democratic Latina governor in the United States. And she made a name for herself as one of the strongest critics of Trump on immigration. One of the strongest critics. She beat out Steve Pierce, who's a conservative member of the Freedom Caucus.
Right.
And now we're going to see how it all works out for New Mexico. So
it's
now it's the first time since 2002 you have a Democrat in the governor's governor's mansion in New Mexico. And I think the New Mexico people are going to be very disappointed in how this all plays out for them. I'll let you close it out.
So too. I agree too. We're going to be in trouble if she makes it. If we're a sanctuary state, I don't know what's going to happen. It's sad. I mean, that we don't have enough help and we don't get enough assistance down here as it is, and they make us a sanctuary state. You might as well just open the borders and here you are. I think we ought to just, these busloads of immigrant illegals are coming across in Antelope Wells. They need to load them up and take them to Santa Fe and dump them out.
Yeah, near where all the liberals are living in Santa Fe. That's actually
right.
Really funny. No, they don't want them there. No way.
Right.
By the way, just to remind everybody, during the election, immigration was not really a top issue in the race. But the polls showed that the two issues which were biggest in this governor's race in New Mexico was the poor quality of public education and the high poverty rate. Well, where do we think that that's going to be improved? In the Democrat Party? Are you kidding me? They're just going to bring in more indigent people from all over the world to New Mexico. That's not going to help grow businesses in New Mexico. You're going to have to raise taxes. You're going to drive businesses out of the state, and you're going to be a magnet for more illegal immigration, which just puts a strain on the public schools. All right, we're out of time. We really appreciate your perspective. Thank you so much. For joining us, Tricia Elbrock, rancher and business owner, female, real pioneer in ranching in New Mexico. We really appreciate her perspective. This is the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast. We return on the Laura Ingraham podcast, and we've talked a lot today about the power of faith, reflection, having that time to really think about where you are in your life, whether you're measuring up to the expectations you set maybe at the beginning of the year, maybe expectations you set 5 years ago or that were set by your parents or your faith, and having those moments to just slow down and think. And
things hit us in different ways and revelations come at different points in our lives. And in the political world and in the struggle that we're seeing our country in now, especially on that issue that I've spent so much time on, which is illegal immigration, we've seen a lot of folks dismiss concerns about safety and security, sovereignty. They dismiss them out of hand as these are concerns just raised by people who don't like brown-skinned people. Oh, you're a mean person. You don't want these poor people to come across the border. How dare you? You can't raise issues of safety or gang affiliation or gang warfare brought on by, in some part, illegal immigration. No, you can't do that. Well, yes, we can. Yes, we were right. And yes, we will continue to discuss these issues. And on the faith question, intersecting with all of this, we came across a really interesting book. Now, it just came out today, and it's called A Latino Gangbanger's Miraculous Escape from a Life of Violence to a New Life in Christ. The author is Casey Diaz, and he joins us now. How he came into this gang, what it's all about, and how he saved himself through the power of Christ, Jesus Christ. He joins us now. Casey, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Casey, for my podcast listeners across the country and across the world, for those of us who want an inside view on how this gang operates and what it's really all about, you are the perfect person to reveal that to us. So tell us.
Well, you know, it's like any gang that grows in numbers. It becomes very organized, and it becomes more dangerous as the numbers increase. And for me, I got the first taste of it at 11 years old when I was introduced to this gang culture.
So you were 11?
I was 11 years old, yes.
So tell us where you were and how you came into the United States and then how you got caught up in this world.
So I came to the United States when I was 2 years old. My family came in here legally, and my mother was a seamstress, and she took on two jobs, you know, from working from 4 in the morning till 10, 11 at night. And, you know, I have my father, who was a very bad alcoholic, very abusive, both verbally and physically with my mom. So here's this lady that, you know, was trying to put food and a roof over our heads, and she comes home to a beating. And so we settled in what's called the Rampart District of Los Angeles. If you're familiar with the Rampart scandal, that's the district that where we landed. And I got introduced at 11 by a local gang member with this gang. And you know, when there's violence at home, and there's you're left to grow up by yourself, you're going to need some kind of mentorship. You're going to need some kind of someone to lead you. And this gang leader, took me under his wing and really taught me the ropes of the streets. And there I was, left to my own demise.
So this was at about 11 years of age, and they offered you what?
They offered me a family, is what initially I thought it was, and it all turned around very quickly for me. My initiation was getting jumped in. There were several gang members that beat you for 13 seconds, and then you got to go out and do something. And for me, it was they took me to go and we caught what we called a rival gang member. We caught him slipping, and this gang leader proceeded to stab the guy and then gave me the screwdriver and said, "Your turn." And so at 11 years old, my first stabbing was done.
Oh, my God. And do you remember how that felt?
It was a very awkward moment. You know, you're 11. I have a 10-year-old, and he has absolutely no clue of that kind of lifestyle. And I'm looking at him at times. I catch myself, and I look at him, and I go, I'm so I'm so blessed that he will never see that side of life ever. And for me, in that moment, it was a dark moment. It was, I had witnessed the first triple murder in the backyard of my alley when I was 8 years old, as a man gunned down three guys right before my eyes. So you see the violence in the home, and then you see the violence outside of your street. Mm-hmm. And very quickly, you think, this is how you handle life, and life becomes very cheap at that moment. Hmm.
Well, it's disposable. Doesn't mean anything. All right, Casey, from the time you did that first stabbing to the time where you were arrested by authorities, give us a brief look into that period.
So you have different ranking systems within the gang, and you have your down line where these other guys are absolutely doing nothing. They dress the part, they walk the part, but they really ain't. They're not involved in the gang violence part of it. And for me, because I was getting coached by a gang leader, it was a hands-on thing. And so I was driven to the violence, and I started to, as horrible as it sounds, I started to like the violent part of this gang.
So you enjoyed the feeling of having power over others? Was that what the allure was, or was it the status combination?
I think it was a combination of both. The fear that that people have towards you, the respect, the sweet respect that you get, and it's a bad thing to get caught up in. But that every gang, and it's in every organized gang that's out there, you are driven by the pride, by the respect, and the causing of fear on the lives of anybody that crosses your path.
If it's the one thing that drove you into the arms of the gang, would it come right down to family abuse?
I would find out later on in life that I would picture my father, me and him had a rough time, growing up, because obviously you're seeing your mom being beat brutally. And so I would find out later on in life that, and I knew this, but I had counseling and all that that's court appointed. I would put the face of my father on every single one of my rival gang members that I ended up stabbing.
So you were acting out the rage that you were building up at home on the street. Well, this is a story, sadly, that's been repeated millions of times around the world, in the United States, and different gangs, different pathologies. And all education begins in the home. All values are taught in the home. The most important values are taught in the home, and it's a toxic combination. I mean, so you teach a kid violence as a solution, and a child will oftentimes replicate that out in public or in his own marriage, and that's just beyond tragic. So tell us about your ultimate arrest, and then what happened.
At 16, I committed murder. I was found guilty of killing a rival gang member from 18th Street, and I was sentenced to 12 years, 8 months. Now, back then in the 80s, if you ended up getting a murder charge, you were only getting, 7 years. I'd seen cases where they only served 4 years. And California is very upside down in that measure. Mm. It was letting violent felons out very quickly. In fact, they were even being sent to the California Youth Authority. But for me, at that moment, at that time, California decided that they were going to see how young could we send a violent offender to state prison. And so I was caught up in the handful of cases where they decided this guy is he's fit for state prison. And what they did at that time was that they would send you to the California Youth Authority to see if there was still any hope for rehabilitation. And in my case, the violence just got bigger and bigger. And while I was in the youth authority, I was caught strangling another 18th Street gang member and brutally beating him. And at that point, the CYA decided this guy is not made for the YA system. And I was sent to the Men's Central Jail to for them to pursue sending me directly to a state prison.
And how old were you when you went into the men's prison?
I was about 18 and some change.
And then how did you come to meet Christ?
So this little church, it wasn't some big church. It was a little small church that came in to solitary confinement to spread the gospel. I had absolutely no sense of religion. I had no knowledge of who Jesus was or the Bible or anything like that. I wasn't interested in that. You know, I was already involved in organized crime at that time within New Folsom State Prison. And so that was, you know, it was an issue that I'd never pursued or talked about. And it was at that moment that this lady by the name of Frances would come in there once a month with this Bible study. And she asked the guards if she could approach myself. And the COs, the correctional officers, discouraged her from approaching my cell. And she asked very boldly if she could approach that cell. And I didn't know that they were talking about me at this moment until the guard said to her, that's Diaz in that cell. You're wasting your time, but go ahead and you can approach the cell. And she came and she invited me to this Bible study. She said, you know, I understand that, you know, you still have to be in chains coming into this Bible study, but at least you're out of your cell for the duration of the Bible study. And I refused. I turned her down. And she said something very colorful at that time. She said, I'm going to put you on my hit list. And what she meant was her prayer hit list. And I thought, those are some choice words for her to use in a place like that.
With you. So, oh.
Yeah. So, I said, you can do whatever you want. And she says, I'm going to pray for you. And Jesus is going to use you. And there was this immense amount of conviction in her voice. And that for 12 months later, more than that, actually, every month, that one time that she came in there, she would stop in my cell and she would always finish her conversation with, I'm praying for you and Jesus is going to use you. I had absolutely no nothing. I didn't know what was going to happen after that. But I had a moment in my cell in which, I speak about in the book. I won't go into details with that, but it was an encounter that was God with myself that made it made it very hard for me to continue in the lifestyle that I was in. And so I took a measure of stepping down from my leadership as a shot caller while I was in there, and immediately a hit was placed on my life for doing so. And it was a tough 2 years that were ahead of me.
We're talking to Casey Diaz, who is a convicted murderer. His new book, A Latino Gangbanger's Miraculous Escape from a Life of Violence to a New Life in Christ. Casey, this kind of sounds like a movie script, doesn't it? I mean, the stories of redemption are what great literature and great poems and great music, great films are often made of. And one person took an interest in you. One. And Frances was compelled to take an interest in you because of her faith. And that was her calling. And now what do you find your calling is after having been approached by a woman who could have walked right by your cell?
You know, I've had the opportunity to speak across the United States and in my church and in Los Angeles, and I've been able to be part of lives that are young. That think, you know, when you're 16, you think you know it.
I remember.
Those are the kind of teens that I like approaching. I've youth pastored for 8.5 years, and then I worked with young adults for another 5 years, and then And then I planted a church in California. And you know, God has been, this is the very unique thing is that God right now has been speaking to a lot of businessmen and the common citizen. And you know, this is a place where God has been. God's using me to bring as many as I can through his help to the Lord. And I'm overwhelmed by God's favor and his mercy and his second chance.
Do you ever keep in touch, Casey, with any of your former fellow inmates, people who are still in prison or are out?
No, you know, I and that's the interesting part is that you would think that God would have me going back to prison and reaching those, but God hasn't had me do that. I have, however, led the guy that took my place when I stepped down from leadership. I lost contact with him for 15 years, and he showed up at my sign shop. I have a sign shop outside the ministry, and I was able to lead an organized gang leader to Christ there, and he's doing great in his own life right now. It's been over a decade that he's been clean and going to church and everything. So, you know, I try to keep an arm's length from that kind of environment. And for, you know, various reasons, but God has me in a place where I'm just discipling the normal person and I'm trying to do whatever God wants me to do in this moment in my life.
What are your thoughts on the issue at the border right now? And it's not the subject of your book, but we're now finding, of course, that MS-13 has brought in a significant number of people across the border in the just crush of people who just want to come and work here and live here. And, of course, that's added to the difficulty in dealing with the gangs we already have in the United States. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, and here's the interesting part of that. You know, I love our president. I love your show. I watch your show quite often. And I think that when we do our homework and we see the numbers of people trying to come in here, look, I understand that people are trying to come in here to seek for a better opportunity, to look for, you know, to seek a dream. But there's a right way and a wrong way to doing this. And not everyone in these caravans, for instance, not everyone in these caravans are coming here to pick our apples. That's the bottom line. That's the truth. And there's a lot of gang activity hidden within these caravans, and I know that. And I, the reason I know that is because I was in meetings before my conversion where we discussed movements of large amounts of drugs and you know, and everything. So when these gang members are disguising themselves in these caravans, they're coming in here with a plan, and they have a plan in mind, and they have a plan to execute. They have a plan to cause chaos. And they're not moving into, you know, suburbs. They're not moving into, I listen to a lot of these journalists and stuff, and they're also letting, you know, open borders, but they're not, what they don't realize is that they're not moving into their neighborhood. They're moving into low-income housing, and their plan is to engage with young 11-year-olds.
Oh, yeah.
And they're gonna go ahead and recruit. That's, you know, they're going to recruit from the middle school all the way to high school. And by that time, we've lost a handful of American lives.
No.
It is so important to pay attention to what our president is saying and doing something about that. And if he says, let's close the border, then we need to close the border, period. It's that serious.
And, Casey, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you're in LA, right? You're in the LA area?
Yes.
Next time I'm out there, and I hope I'm out there fairly soon, next time I'm out there, let's get together and have a meal and talk. I bet some stuff we can do together, all right? Would you like to do that?
I would love to do that. It would be an honor.
I want to meet your family.
Oh, wow.
I want to meet the fam. How many kids do you have?
I have three.
What are their ages?
I have one in a private university. She's about to turn 19.
Wow.
I have one. The other two are in private schools. So I got two girls. One's about to be graduate from her high school. And then I have a 10-year-old boy, Jacob.
Well, I bet you have them on the straight and narrow. I can bet that right now. I bet those kids are... You're studying. You better be home by curfew or that's it. I can't...
That's right.
Now knowing... Given where you were, there is no way that you're going to be... You're going to be like, yeah, come home whenever you want. Yeah, I don't think so.
No, there's none of that.
I don't think so. Hey, Casey, I love the book. You know, you turned a life of depravity and crime and killing into a life where you're shedding light. And I mean, this is why we're Christians. This is why we believe, because, you know, like as the song goes, once was lost and now I'm found. I love this book. I love the fact that you're speaking out, and keep doing it. And we'll see you out in LA. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Laura. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely. We'll definitely continue the conversation. Casey Diaz, the book, A Latino Gangbanger's Miraculous Escape from a Life of Violence to a New Life in Christ. It's on our website, lauraingram.com. It'll be on Facebook. And this is an issue, sadly, that's not going away. The scourge of this gang and what it's doing to our communities, to our youth, and what we can do to stop this. Remember, it all starts in the family. Always does. Thanks for listening to the best of the Laura Ingram Podcast.
Grab a 30-day free trial of Live by Live Plus, and you'll get unlimited skips, commercial-free music, and all of the podcasts and live streaming events you can handle. Visit livexlive.com/podcast1 to learn more and start your free trial.
I hope you're enjoying this. The Laura Ingram Podcast. This is the best of. And thank you for listening. We love your feedback. Always love your opinions. Want to hear from you. So you can email the show at ingram.podcast@gmail.com. That's ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Email me with your thoughts, or if you want to get on the show, just email me the topic you want to talk about or react to the topic we're tweeting or Facebooking out. ingram.podcast@gmail.com. Keep the comments coming. All right, back on the Laura Ingram Podcast. Delighted you are with us, as always. Oh, boy. We have so much to get to. Of course the left is going so far left, they've left America. I mean, of course they are. What else are they going to do? Focus on the fact that we have 3% GDP, the strongest economy in the world, the place where everybody wants to do business, increased optimism, more economic opportunity for minorities than we've had, certainly in my lifetime. What are they going to do, talk about that? No, they got to talk about how Trump's, even if we can't prove he's a Russian agent, there's got to be something somewhere. It's one of the business deals he's done. It's gotten just, it's so pathetic. That's why I was saying last weekend when I was away for 3 days in New Orleans, it was like a dream, because people there just, they were focused on, you know, Mardi Gras and being with their families and just enjoying life. And the Democrats have now become the unfun party. They're just the party of perpetual malcontents, pot and abortion. Even the pot's not making them happy. I thought pot was supposed to make them happy. They're all smoking pot and they love pot. Pot legalization is going to bring us all the things we really want. So it's pot, abortion, and transgenderism. That's kind of that kind of sums it all up, don't you think? One of our absolute favorites and my favorites. I like to just say, yeah, I know he's been writing books for years. I know he's like one of the most renowned military historians, an expert, especially in the Korean Peninsula, one wonderful writer and columnist. But I like to feel like I discovered him. He's going to laugh. Victor Davis Hanson, his brand new book. And it is awesome. The Case for Trump. And it's just out. You have to get this book. I'm telling you, you get this book for people you love and people who don't love Trump. You love them and they love Trump, they're going to love it. And if they don't love Trump, and if even they dislike Trump, they're going to learn something in this book. And at the very least, he'll annoy them. So in other words, you're going to have a lot of books to buy. He joins us now, Victor Davis Hanson. Hey, Victor, how are you?
Very good, Laura. Thanks for having me.
I mean, I like to think that I discovered you, at least for TV. I mean, I like now everybody has you on TV. Come on. Come on, VDH. Give me a break.
No, I agree with you. You're my parent.
Oh, my gosh. Do you? I mean, I want to get in deep into this book because it could not come at a better time. I can tell you that right now. And you and I have been talking about this for so many years, how the American left has just decided everything this country was founded upon, pretty much every enduring principle and the traditions, have to be eroded or done away with in order to reach their social justice utopia. And now this entire phenomenon has infected the Democrat Party.
Yeah, it has. I mean, Trump in 2016 ran partly on the premise he wasn't Hillary, but in 2020, it looks like he's going to be running on the premise that he's the only thing between us, the American people, and socialism, or worse. I mean, all those issues you mentioned, and reparations, abolishing ICE, infanticide, Green Deal, they don't have 40% public approval, and yet that's going to be the stamp that every candidate's going to have to be stamped with if they want to get the nomination. So it's going to be a great gift for Trump. It's amazing. It's like 1972 all over again with McGovern.
Yeah, I mean, let's start. You talk a lot in this book about Comey and the the viciousness within the FBI and deep state that was directed against Trump and Clapper and so forth. But because it's an issue that you and I have batted around for so many years, I want to start with immigration. Because we in Trump, as you point out, we had the first president who actually reflected, I believe, the traditional understanding of what immigration is supposed to be and why it matters and why it matters to have legal immigration versus illegal immigration. And he decided to throw away the Bush philosophy, throw away the old Chamber of Commerce philosophy for the most part, although there's some creeping problems there. But he was the first one who sort of said it doesn't have to be like this. And he's being resisted for that.
In a weird way, for somebody who was supposed to be anti-Mexican, it was the most empathetic to Hispanics because it said, I'm not going to let cheap wages erode your entry-level jobs. If you're legal and you have a green card, you're a citizen. And it worked. We see people in California that have leverage over the employer. They're happy they're not being competed with illegal labor. And then also their schools were impacted. Their neighborhoods were infested with gangs. They're not a natural constituency for open borders. And when you add that infanticide and the anti-Catholic bias that we saw with Harris and Feinstein and Hirono, Trump has a great opportunity to say this is a party of anti-Hispanics if he'll do it. And I think he can get 40% of the vote. And given their alienation of the white working class, 40% Hispanic or 15% African American, that's fatal to the Democrats in 2020. So he should really work on that.
Well, and you're seeing his numbers, of course, go up among Hispanics. And I think a lot of the Hispanic voters legally here, legally voting, they left their home country because they don't want this country to become El Salvador or Honduras. They enjoy this economy too. And I think if he continues to do outreach to both the Latino community and the African American community, I mean real outreach, not one trip a cycle, but one trip a month.
I agree.
That would be meaningful, absolutely. Really meaningful.
And when you see African-American and Hispanic spokesmen for Trump, they're usually people that run businesses or they're practical, but they're not media creations or university creations or intellectual creations. And they sound much more attuned with working people. And that really helps him. I know that you've had a lot of African-American pastors on your show, some Hispanics. They just sound so much more commonsensical than these guys that inhabit Washington and go in and out of think tanks and the universities and the Democratic elite. And it's kind of a grassroots version of Trumpism that he appeals to a particular type of minority that's confident, successful, and worries about people in the real concrete sense rather than all of these what is the African-American community doing with this transgender agenda? That's not a key issue for them, for anybody, but especially given the problems in that community, it's not transgenderism. And as far as abortion, it should be abortion, and they shouldn't be supporting infanticide. So I think Trump can really appeal to a grassroots segment of that population, like the way he did in the Midwest in 2016.
Yeah, and I'm going to get into the issue of Trump not being of Washington. And you write about this in this is page 109 in the chapter called Modern Day Presidential. We're going to get into it in a moment. But before we do that, the socialism allure on the left now, and they're selling it to young people in universities, and they're describing it as something very different from the socialism of the 20th century. And this is going to be something that delivers more equality and lifestyle equality, income inequality, and so forth. Trump has decided, Victor, to take this on head on, as he did at CPAC. Let's listen.
Socialism is not about the environment. It's not about justice. It's not about virtue. Socialism is about only one thing. It's called power for the ruling class. That's what it is. Look at what's happening in Venezuela and so many other places. All of us are here today because we know that the future does not belong to those who believe in socialism.
Do you agree he has to expand on that and continue to drive that home, Victor?
Yeah, I do. And I really like the idea that he's hitting the hypocrisy of socialists, that they profess one ideology for everybody else, and then they expect that they need special privileges. And we've already seen it with people like Bernie Sanders and AOC, but they're immune from the ramifications of their own ideology. So that's a really good issue to exploit and just say, you know what? It's all about people in their dacas in Russia or Mao and his enclave. And they never really want to experience what they demand for other people. That's a winning issue. It really is, especially for a population that really had thought that question was over with. We just didn't think that socialism existed anymore. And if you called a Democrat a socialist, it was sort of like calling him a communist. You didn't do it. And now it's a badge of honor with him. So it's a reflection, I guess, of the university that we've forgotten, we've been asleep on the right, that these entire generation professors are not liberal Democrats, they're socialists, and they're teaching hardcore socialists. And then when you add the economy under Obama and the last years of Bush, and gosh, home prices went up, student debt was pretty high, and you had this new profile of a pajama boy, Life of Julia, hipster, where they don't marry or have children or buy a home until their 40s. And it was just something that the Republicans missed, that they created this weird profile that was very susceptible to arrogant on one hand, but ignorant and susceptible to socialism on the other.
We're talking to Victor Davis Hanson. His book, The Case for Trump, just out. It's on our Facebook page, of course, and you follow me on Twitter. And you see my tweets about it. You got to get this book. Really, and one thing that I love about this modern day presidential chapter, Victor, is that you tap into Trump's appeal, his physical appeal and his vocal appeal, which I think is hilarious because I like how all these politicians go to the Iowa State Fair and they're so inauthentic. You know, they ditch their, you know, Brooks Brothers suit, and they put on a pair of jeans and a flannel shirt, and we're supposed to think they're authentic, right? And Trump shows up in his suit, in his long red tie, in his baggy pants, and just looking like Trump. And he's basically saying with that, I'm not one of these other people. These people have screwed us up royally. I'm not one of them. And the never Trumpers, you know, the Republicans that you've written about so often in the whole National Review, never Trump crowd, those guys found him to be such a vulgarian. I mean, they despised his they still do, like Mona Sharon, these people who I like. I like Mona as a person. She's a wonderful person, but they just despise him as a person. Forget his policies and his look. But he's like, to hell with that. This is who I am. And the regular people love that.
Yeah, you know, when I wrote that, I talked to a lot of farmers. He came out to raise money in the San Joaquin Valley, and I said to one of them, well, what was he like? Because I didn't go. And he said, oh, he's the same old guy. He has these weird slacks and red tie down below his crotch.
What is that,
that
tie?
Crazy New York accent, Canadian, the Queens accent. And I said, you mean he didn't get the cowboy hat, the red flannel shirt, the hay? No, he said he didn't want any of that. And remember how Hillary would always mimic a Southern accent, or you all, or Boilermakers, or Obama with Bull, or when Obama got into the inner city, he dropped the G's, and Kerry put on the camouflage. But that was one of his strengths, that he was, whatever he was authentic, and he was the same, and he was genuine. And that proved to be much more receptive for people in the Midwest than the John Kasich, who kept telling us that his dad was a mailman and he was a man of the people. But they all came off as inauthentic in comparison to Trump. And, you know, he can say anything at any time to anybody, anywhere, and that appeals to people after what we've been through with this political class.
I like this part, okay? This is why you have to read the book, because it's also very funny. A few mostly superlative adjectives sufficed. Awesome, beautiful. We should have Raymond read this. Fantastic, great, huge, incredible, sad, stupid, terrible, big league, and zero, along with stock adverbs such as tremendously. There were familiar nouns and emphatics. Believe me, millions and billions, or moron, winning and winners were to be emulated. Losing and losers signaled a disgrace. Everything and everything Trump fought was a disaster. Was Trump then monotonous? Of course. Did it matter? Perhaps not, at least not in the short term, because repetition reemphasized basic messages delivered in a few syllables. Moreover, Trump could offer strange riffs of endearment. What other politician in his sober and judicious mind would ever think up the provocative, beautiful, clean coal? I love that. Or a beautiful wall on the southern border. You know something? I had never thought of that, but those, that kind of gathering of simple words, Victor, they stay in your mind. And in the left kind of ridicules them on Saturday Night Live, but regular people, I don't know, it makes them smile. I just think people enjoy that.
It does.
I don't know what it is, but people, I mean, I'm laughing just reading it, but I love it. I think it's great.
No, I agree. And then it's also empathetic. As I said, nobody ever, I can't imagine Mitt Romney, and I voted for him, I liked him, but my gosh, he would have never gone in and said, our miners, our vets. Mm-mm. So there was something about Trump that wasn't phony, that he had, of all people, a natural empathy for working people. And that came across his vocabulary and the words that he chose. And I think everybody in the establishment missed that. And they said he's a buffoon. He has a limited vocabulary. How can people be for him? But they had no idea of history, that a lot of very effective speakers have had a very small vocabulary for that purpose. Not that I'm not saying that he did, but the result didn't matter because it was effective. And I'll meet people and they'll say to me, I said, did you go to the Trump rally? And you said it was tremendous. It was awesome.
It was huge.
They like that.
No, okay. Now, I'm reading this because it's making me smile. Trump had never read Demosthenes or Cicero, but either by ear or instinct, he employed oxymorons, consonants, alliteration, ellipsis, and anaphora. Of course, he certainly was not the prepared speaker of the caliber of JFK and Ronald Reagan or polished teleprompter reader of Obama. But perhaps more entertaining in ad hoc repartee than Obama, and as good as JFK, Bill Clinton, or Reagan. And I'm telling you, the back and forth, his little side commentary when he gives a speech, when he kind of goes off and he does the side commentary like, oh, I guess I can't fly to see you, Grandma, because the sun's not out. Like funny things like that about solar power and stuff, even if it's not quite accurate, is very entertaining. And I think politics is supposed to be fun. It is supposed to be fun.
Yeah,
I mean, if it's done right.
And he's getting better at it. When he makes fun of himself, when he said, you know, if I started to drink, I'd be an utter disaster. And that really resonates. And because it destroys this idea that he's an egomaniac. He makes fun of himself now. It's getting better. He's getting better, and the opposition's getting worse. And once this Mueller investigation is over, I have a feeling that he will be liberated to release a lot of documents that won't be redacted on FISA warrants and unmasking. It's going to really shock us.
Victor, what?
I hope so.
Yeah, I certainly hope so, too. I want to play something for you from our favorite socialist, Bernie Sanders, who was on he was on a show yesterday and discussing, you know, what his view of health care would actually mean to the average person. Let's listen.
The criticism of Bernie Sanders is he's going to raise your taxes. Well, I may. That's right. But you know what I'm doing? I'm doing away with all of your private health insurance premiums. All right. I don't know how you guys work or where you get your health care from. Mm-hmm. Somebody is paying for it. Somebody's paying Blue Cross or United Health. All right. That's gone.
So that is that going to be tempting enough for people, for Sanders? Well, okay, well, you don't have that health insurance anymore. This is where Trump's education of the American people and some pretty big speeches, I think, is going to have to kick in.
Yeah, I think so. I think the subtext of that is he's going to give Medicare for everybody, and he's going to break the bond that it was founded on, that you work as when you're young and healthy to contribute to a system and payroll taxes, and then you benefit when you're older and you're not so healthy. And he's going to destroy that and say Medicare for everybody, which means Medicare for nobody. It won't work. It's like it'll be like the DMV. You go in the DMV, it's all free. There's two windows open and 20 of them are closed, whether it's a mile line out the door. And that's what it will be like. It's already being like that in California with Obamacare. So when you tell people you don't have to pay a premium or there's not going to be a copay very much, then people, they abuse the system, even on healthcare. And everybody wants cheap insurance that's affordable. And the only way you're going to get that is to encourage more competition, not less, and have tailored plans for particular people the way we used to. But this is frightening. And then when you add in this whole calculus that they own three houses, his wife's had kind of a business deal where she inflated the value of property for her presidency when they were doing mm-hmm. that campus. It's not Bernie Sanders, man of the people. It's Bernie Sanders, swamp creature, who has never really worked outside government and doesn't really know how things work in the real business world or the free market. And yet, you know, he's going to appeal to that section of the electorate that's mostly young and urban and can't buy a house and doesn't, like Ocasio-Cortez, don't have children, that kind of stuff. And if you buy a house and you have children and you have a household, by nature you become conservative, and that's what they don't want. They understand that.
Victor,
so
I want to.
It's a pajama boy message.
Yeah. I want to now think moving forward. I've had long conversations with friends about this. Can the president win re-election running the same type of campaign he ran in 2016, given the fact that the Democrats are now vowing not to be surprised? And obviously many billionaires on the left working from the local to the state to the national level to fund organizations and groups to get out the vote and so forth.
No, I don't think he can at all. We saw that in California. There was 15 congressional districts that the Republican won basically on Election Day. And when they got done vote harvesting and et cetera, 3 weeks later, they'd only won seven. So they're going to be a massive voter registration, quote-unquote, vote harvesting effort, change the electorate. There's going to be a lot of voting fraud. And he's going to have to be very, very much better prepared before the election. And by that, I mean registering voters, getting them out, harvesting his own voters in the sense that targeting people, registering them, getting to the polls or getting their ballots to the polls. If he doesn't, he's going to get killed. In his defense, he's going to be running as the anti-socialist. And these candidates, they might be more mellifluous than Hillary Clinton, but compared to her, they're so hard left that the divide will be easier. And as I said, he's better as a candidate. And he did. I think the Never Trump people are pretty much impotent now. They're not going to be a factor at all. Mm-hmm. So there's certain things, and the incumbents have an advantage. But I think that this race is going to be won or lost on turnout and registration.
Absolutely. Victor Davis Hanson, congratulations. The book, The Case for Trump, just out. Again, it's on our Facebook page on Amazon.com. Get it at any bookstore. But I disagree with what Newt wrote on the cover. He gave you a blurb. It said a must read for everyone who supports the president. It's a must read for everyone who doesn't support the president, I think, because you'll see now what he was up against and why it's so important for him, I think, to be reelected. And I'm not offended at all that in a book that was 300 and no, I'll be like Trump. I'm not offended at all that in a book that's over 300 pages, my name's not mentioned one time, Victor. I'm not in any way offended by that. By that. But that's what I do. I look for
you. You're there in spirit, Laura.
Jeez, I was one of the first people supporting him. I'm not in the case for Trump. Come on, what's going on there, VDH? No, but I'm like Trump.
Spirit, I go. You inspired it.
Yeah, I'm going to the index to look for my name. How pathetic is that? Victor, it's great to have you on. Come on TV soon. Congratulations. America, now and forever, you're listening to the best of the Laura Ingraham podcast.
Grab a 30-day free trial of Live by Live Plus, and you'll get unlimited skips, commercial-free music, and all of the podcasts and live streaming events you can handle. Visit livexlive.com/podcast1 to learn more and start your free trial.